Okay, so welcome everybody to today's sutta class, dealing with Majjhima Nikaya number 29, the Mahasaropama Sutta, the great discourse on the simile of the heartwood. And of course this being word sara, as in Dhamma Sara, and many other, one of the very common word found in Pali, Sanskrit, using meaning the essence or the heart of something. It doesn't literally always mean heartwood, although in this case, as it's applied, it does mean heartwood. That's one of the meanings of it, but can be often used just more generally to mean the essence or something. Now, this course has only one parallel, Chinese parallel, which is in the Ekotara Agama, not in the Madhyama Agama. So, interestingly enough, doesn't seem to be any Sarvastivadin versions of this. Perhaps yet to be found, perhaps lurking in the sands of Afghanistan, or perhaps blown up by a Taliban bomb somewhere. There was the Mahasaropama Sutra. That's fortunately for all of you, you don't have to listen to all the comparative details of the two. Right. Now, this discourse gives a number of things which are regarded as not being the essence of the holy life. And it starts out on one occasion, Blessed One was living at Rajagaha in the Gijakuta, the vultures, it is Gijha, and Kuta means a pointy thing. Okay, so we have the Kuti is a pointy thing. And so the Gijakuta is the vulture's peak, we translate. And of course we had a look at the photo on the slide a couple of months ago. We saw the picture of the vulture's peak, and you see it actually has like a rock that's shaped in the shape of a vulture's head, being obviously why it's called Vulture's Peak. The other reason for calling it Vulture's Peak would be because vultures hung out there, but vultures hung out everywhere in India, so that's probably not a good reason for calling it that. And Achira Pakante, Achira, not long, Pakanta, go away. Okay, kanta is to go, pa means out, go away, devadatte, tatrako, and then the Blessed One said, exhorted the bhikkhus, devadattang arabha, meaning about, concerning, with regards to, devadatta. Now, as was mentioned, as we were so correctly reminded yesterday by Eva that Devadatta was the naughty one. He was the Judas of the Buddha's story, the set of the Buddha's story, the betrayer. Yeah, and it seems that every good story has to have its bad guy somewhere. And to make the story better, the bad guy has to get worse and worse and worse to make the good guy look better and better and better. And so over the years one finds that the stories told about Devadatta get more and more and more lurid and colourful, and his crimes get more and more outrageous. Yeah. So there has been in recent years some attempt to rehabilitate poor old Devadatta, and some of the modern scholars, as is their wont, like to deconstruct everything and look at everything from a different point of view. And so it's always instructive to try to do that, even if you might not end up agreeing with it. But it's always useful to adopt that point of view and see what the point might have been. And so the point of view that they would take is that Devadatta was a forest monk, right? Because he wanted to live at the roots of trees. And he wanted to be very ascetic and was encouraging these ascetic values. And so, according to Reginald Ray, he was the archetype of the forest ascetic monk. Whereas the Sangha at that time was becoming more settled. This is something we discussed recently about the Sangha becoming more settled. And so Sariputta especially was the archetype of the kind of the settled city monk, according to this particular reading. I'm not saying this is true. I'm simply saying this particular thesis has been promulgated. And so Devadatta was trashed comprehensively and thoroughly and sent down to burn in hell for the rest of the eon, because of his espousal of the ascetic values of the early Buddhism. So that's one way of looking at it. Well, yes, but
Reginald Ray acknowledged the title called the Buddha.
Ah, yeah, but that's all just that's just the propaganda.
Oh, that's not true. That's what he's saying.
I would guess so, yeah. It's been some time since I read it, but yeah, I guess that's all the propaganda. And the other reason was that there was one or two statements in the later accounts of Buddhism in India, I'm not sure where from, maybe Xuanzang or something, who said that there were actually disciples of Devadatta living several, many centuries later, after the Buddha. And so if that was the case, then the story that he was completely demolished obviously wouldn't be true. And so several scholars, including Professor A.K. Warder, have taken this quite seriously. When I mentioned this to Ajahn Brahm a number of years ago, he said, he said that even today, if any monks start a vegetarian order, then they'll immediately be told, oh, you're disciples of Devadatta. Yeah? And so this is what happens in Thailand, like with Yantra's followers or Sati Asok and things like that. As soon as you set up a vegetarian order, the monks who like their bit of carcass will try to criticize you by saying that you're disciples of Devadatta, because that was one of the things that he requested. So he thinks that that's not particularly historical. So you don't think that that's ethical to say, I'm not going to kill it, but I'm going to get somebody else to kill it for me?
I mean, you don't have to answer it much. Maybe it's the consideration that came
up. Yeah, it's not. It's certainly not an easy one. I mean, I my personal view is that I think we should be vegetarian. We should certainly at least try. And it's interesting if you look at how it's played out in Buddhist history that those traditions which do embrace vegetarianism tend to give up the alms practice. Unless you can even see this is the case, even say in Thailand where alms practice is very strong, but those traditions which are very strongly vegetarian, it's very difficult for them to keep up just going into the village for alms because the villagers give them meat. And so they tend to move towards a situation where the food is being grown and supplied by the monastics and not the monasteries. So this is one kind of side effect of it. And it's worked, it's funny, it's played out very differently in different places. Like in Sri Lanka, as I understand, there's very little meat consumed. I mean, they have fishermen who are probably Tamils, I guess, and they sort of do fishing, and of course they have some meat, but basically they have very largely vegetarian diet, as you can see from the food which the Sri Lankans bring here is almost always vegetarian.
Almost.
Yeah, not completely, but very largely vegetarian, whereas in Thailand it's completely not. In Thailand, it's very, very much a meat-based diet. And, you get very misled. If you eat Thai food in Australia, then you get very misled about what Thai food actually is in Thailand. But it's basically meat. It's what they eat, really. Everything's cooked in pork fat and flavoured with rotten fish. And you go, and it's amazing the difference. You go around Thailand, there's no birds anywhere, there's no wildlife, you know. We noticed that immediately. As soon as we went to India, you can see wildlife everywhere, you know. There's birds around, the big birds, storks and vultures and things. Sorry?
The Englishman for meat doesn't get any bad karma.
Yeah.
The person who supplies it may do.
Yeah.
Maybe they
do. Supplying meat is one of the kinds of wrong livelihood. So being involved in the meat trade is definitely a kind of wrong livelihood.
But supplying meat to monks on alms round, could that be a counter effect? You know, one is that they didn't get in there,
they might be killing the chicken, but they killed that one.
And they do, and that happens quite regularly, yeah. Mm-hmm. They go fishing or they kill one of their chooks or whatever. Yeah. So this is kind of black and white karma that leads to black and white results.
There was talk about this in the community lately, and how the Buddha allowed meat if it wasn't killed for your purpose, so on and so forth. Well, maybe the Buddha would have changed his mind if he saw the way that meat is produced these days.
Yeah.
The way meat is produced in India.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, I think that's a very, very valid point. You know, in India in those days, and same in basically all village cultures, what's meat? Meat is you got some chooks clucking around the farmyard and they sort of have a fairly normal, happy, chuckly life as far as chickens can go, and then one day their head gets chopped off, or you've got fish who are kind of swimming in the stream and having a fairly normal, happy life as fish, and then one day they get killed. or cows wandering about the place, being holy, and then one day they get their heads chopped off. So that's the kind of the life that they had. But these days, of course, the life is just so much torment from beginning to end. It's so unnatural and so incredibly painful and so much suffering that I think it's quite different just on that level, not to mention all of the other environmental problems associated with meat eating, and the fact that eating meat and getting meat protein requires vastly more resources, energy resources, physical resources, material resources than vegetarian proteins. So on and so forth. So there's so many very good reasons for not eating meat. So, but it should be said that one of the things, Devadatta asked for 5 allowances, and none of the allowances were considered to be things which were bad in and of themselves. Yeah? They're all things like to live at the root of trees and to, you know, wear rag robes and have arms around practice and things like this. So it was all, it wasn't as if he was asking for bad things, it was just that he was trying to impose these rules on the Sangha as a way of trying to split the Sangha. Yeah? This was the problem. It wasn't actually that what he was asking for was wrong in and of itself.
Five rupees,
rag robes. It's probably in here. Not except meat. Anyway, let's have a look. It's probably in here. I've got here the passage from the Vinaya about Devadatta. So I might just, before we go on, I might just read this, because when we hear so many stories about Devadatta, so many myths and so many legends, that it all becomes rather built up. And so there's this quite a nice section in the Vinaya, in the Sangha Bheda Khandaka, chapter on schism, which is the earliest canonical source. So of course the stuff on Devadatta is scattered everywhere. So we've got this one sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya and bits and pieces everywhere. So you don't find all of the bits gathered together in one place. But nevertheless, this is the place where most of the things are found. So at one time, the Blessed One was staying at Anupiya, a little town of the Mallas. So Mallas being where the Buddha passed away eventually. It's a republic slightly to the south of the Sakyan Republic. At that time, many distinguished Sakyan young men had gone forth in imitation of the Lord who had gone forth. Now at that time, Mahanama the Sakyan and Anuruddha the Sakyan were two brothers. We've met Mahanama earlier. Anuruddha was delicately brought up. He had three palaces, one for the cold weather, one for the hot, one for the rains. He was waited for the 4 months in the palace for the rains by female musicians and did not come down from that place. And so on. So, and this is the story of Mahanama and Anuruddha and their going forth. And Anuruddha's going forth. Anuruddha says, I can't go forth because I've been delicately brought up. And Mahanama says, well, okay, I'll go forth and you can do the household work. He says, that's fine. He said, what's the household work? He says, okay, here it is. First, the fields have to be ploughed. After having them ploughed, they must be sown. After having them sown, water must be led into them. When water is led into them, the water must be led away. Having led the water away, you must have the weeds dug up. Having had the weeds dug up, you must get the crop reaped. Having had the crop reaped, you must have it harvested. Having had it harvested, you must have it made into stooks, which means bundles. Having made it into bundles, you must have it threshed. Having made it threshed, you must have the straw winnowed. Having the straw winnowed, you must have the chaff winnowed. Having had the chaff winnowed, you must have it sifted. Having had it sifted, you must have it brought in. Having had it brought in, it is to be done the same the next year, and to be the same the next year. The work does not stop. No end to the work is to be seen. When will the work stop? When will an end to the work be seen? When will we, possessed of and provided with the fivefold strand of sense pleasures, amuse ourselves unconcernedly? But, dear Anuruddha, the work does not stop. No end of the work is seen. Even when our fathers and grandfathers passed away, the work did not come to an end. Well now, said Anuruddha, You know all about what's going to the household life. I'll go forth from the homelessness. Then Anuruddha approached his mum. Said, Mum, I want to go forth. I want to be a monk. When this spoke, and the mother Anuruddha spoke thus. Okay. I can't let you go forth. Even if you were dead, I wouldn't be willingly separated from you. Now, the mother says, okay, well, Bhadya is a friend of Anuruddha, and he was at that time the Raja of the Sakyans, the Sakyan chieftain. And the mum said, okay, well, look, if Badia agrees to go forth with you, then you can go forth. So he did that, and then eventually he waited for 7 days, and then he decided to go forth. And then Badia, the Sakyan chieftain, and Anuruddha, and Ananda, and Bhagu, and Kimbila, and Devadatta, with Upali the barber as the seventh. As they had often previously gone out from the ground in a pleasure grove with a fourfold army, so did they now go out in a fourfold army. They went out, they sent back the army, took off their ornaments, tied them into a bundle with the upper robes, and they spoke thus to Upali the barber, "Come, good Upali, return, this will be enough for your livelihood." Then it occurred to Upali the barber as he was going back, the Sakyans are fierce. They're all going to think, this barber has made the young men come forth, and they might even kill me. But if these young Sakyan princes will go forth from home into homelessness, why should not I? Then, having tied the bundle of goods up on a tree, he said, whoever sees it, it is given to him, let him take it. He approached the young Sakyan men when they saw him. They said, why, good Upali, have you returned? And he said, I thought the Sakyans are fierce, they might even kill me. At which the Sakyan princes said, you did well, good Upali. The Sakyans are fierce, they may well have killed you. And then they arrived at the Buddha, and they said to him, we, Lord, are the Sakyans. We are proud. Lord, this barber Upali has been our attendant for a long time. May the Lord let him go forth first. We will greet him, rise up before him, salute him with joined palms, and do the proper duties. Thus will our Sakyan pride be humbled in us Sakyans. Then the Lord let Upali the barber go forth first, and afterwards these young Sakyan men. Then the Venerable Bhadia, within 1 year, realized the threefold knowledge. The Venerable Anuruddha gained the divine eye. The Venerable Ananda realized the fruit of stream attainment. And Devadatta acquired ordinary psychic powers. Kutujana. Okay, so some more stories of Bhadia and so on, which is very nice, but I'll just omit it for now. Then,
and this is the Ananda?
The Ananda, yes.
There's a war yoga.
That's right, yes. And then the Lord, having stayed at Anupiya as long as he found suiting, set out on arms tour for Kosambi. And he stayed in Kosambi at Gosita's monastery. Then as Devadatta was meditating in private, a thought arose in his mind thus, whom now could I please? So that because he was pleased with me, much gain and honour would accrue for me. Okay. Then it occurred to Devadatta, this prince Ajatasattu is young and also has an auspicious future. What now if I were to make Prince Ajatasattu pleased, so that because he is pleased with me, much gain and honour would accrue to me? So, of course, Prince Ajatasattu at that time being the heir apparent to the throne of Magadha, which at that time was rivaled Kosala as the greatest kingdom in India. And of course, he says, by saying he has an auspicious future, then in a sense this is quite correct, because Ajatasattu began the expansionist program of Magadha, which ended up a couple of hundred years later in Ashoka's empire, the greatest empire that India ever knew. Then he went to Rajagaha. Then Devadatta, having discarded his own form, having assumed the form of a young boy clad in a girdle of snakes, appeared in Prince Ajatasattu's lap. Then Prince Ajatasattu was afraid, anxious, fearful, alarmed. And Devadatta spoke thus to Prince Ajatasattu, are you, Prince, afraid of me? Yes, I am afraid. Who are you? I am Devadatta. If you are really Master Devadatta, please appear in your own form. And then Devadatta, having thrown off the form of a young boy, stood wearing his outer cloak and other robes and carrying his bowl before Prince Ajatasattu. Prince Ajatasattu, greatly pleased with this wonder of psychic power on Devadatta's part, morning and evening went to wait on him with 500 chariots, and 500 offerings of rice cooked in milk were brought as a gift of food. There rose to Devadatta, overcome by gains, honours and fame, his mind obsessed them, some such longing as this, it is I who will lead the Sangha of Bhikkhus. But at the very occurrence of this thought, Devadatta's psychic powers disappeared.
The way this is coming from is considered the later version vilifying Devadatta, or is this considered authentic, what you're reading?
My reading?
What you the
Ah, well, this is certainly one of the earlier textual sources, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is straight from the Pali Vinaya. Yeah. Then when the Buddha heard about this, he said, "Do not, monks, envy Devadatta's gains and honours and fame. For as long, monks, as Prince Ajatasattu goes morning and evening to wait on Devadatta, then there may be expected for Devadatta decline in skilled mental states, not growth. As it is as if, monks, they were to throw a bladder at a fierce dog's nose. As that dog, monks, would become much fiercer. Even so, as long as Prince Ajatasattu waits on Devadatta, his decline, he'll decline in skilled mental states, not grow. Devadatta's gains, honours and fames bring about his own hurt, his own destruction, just as a plantain tree bears fruit to its own destruction." Now, at that time, the Lord was sitting down teaching Dhamma surrounded by a large company, by a company including the king. Then Devadatta, rising from his seat, having arranged his upper robe over one shoulder, having saluted the Lord with joined palms, spoke thus to the Lord, "Bhante, the Blessed One is now old, worn, stricken in years. He has lived his span and is at the close of his life." So this is one of the indications that Devadatta, of course, is quite a lot younger than the Buddha. And as Devadatta went forth in the same generation as Ananda, also suggestive that Ananda was also quite a lot younger than the Buddha. This is a bit of a controversial issue, but it seems most likely Ananda was at least 20 or 30 years younger than the Buddha, even though the tradition says they were of the same age. "Lord, let the Lord now be content to live devoted to abiding in ease here and now. Let him hand over the Sangha of Bhikkhus to me. It is I who will lead the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Enough, Devadatta, do not lead this order of Bhikkhus." And Devadatta repeated it up to the third time. And the Buddha said, "Devadatta, I would not hand over the Sangha of Bhikkhus even to Sariputta and Moggallana. How then could I hand it over to you, a wretched one, to be vomited like spit?" Then Devadatta, thinking, "The Lord, in an assembly which included the king, disparaged me by calling me a lump of spit," angry and displeased, he departed, keeping his right side. And this was the first time that Devadatta felt malice towards the Lord. And then the Lord addressed the monk, saying, "Well then, let the order carry out a formal act of information against," this is Pakasaniya Kama, which is to inform the lay people that the Devadatta's nature has changed and that he should only be seen as an individual and not seen as representative of the Sangha. So, and Sariputta was given the authority to do that. Now, then Devadatta approached Prince Ajatasattu and said this, "Formerly, Prince, people were long-lived. Today they are short-lived, and it is possible that you, while still a prince, might pass away. Now, why don't you, Prince, having slain your father, become the king? I, having killed the Buddha, will become the Buddha." And the Prince Ajatasattu thinking, "Now Master Devadatta is of great psychic power and majesty. He must know what's right. Having fastened a dagger against his thigh at an early hour, although afraid, anxious, fearful and alarmed, he entered the king's private quarters. But the chief ministers in attendance saw him coming at an early hour. Seeing him, they laid hold of him. They examined and they saw the dagger bound against his thigh. And they asked him, 'What is it, Prince, that you want to do?' He said, 'I want to kill my father.' As you do. By whom are you being incited? By Master Devadatta." And then everybody said, they said the prince should be killed and Devadatta and all the monks should be killed. Well, and then others said, "No, hang on, the monks shouldn't be killed," but they didn't do anything. But the prince should be killed and Devadatta should be killed. And then other ministers gave the opinion, "The prince shouldn't be killed, nor Devadatta, nor should the monks be killed. The king should be told and will do whatever the king says." So they went to the king, and then he called Prince, this is King Bimbisara, of course, spoke thus to Prince, he called Prince Ajatasattu before him and said, "Why, Prince, do you want to slay me?" He said, "Sire, I wish to have the kingdom." And the king said, "If that be the case, prince, then the kingdom is yours." And he handed over the kingdom to Prince Ajatasattu. Prudent. Then, Devadatta told Prince Ajatasattu, "Command your men to kill Rukhlus Gotama." And then he commanded his men, saying, "Do whatever Devadatta says." And so then they sent all these assassins to go and kill him, but they went to kill him, and then, unfortunately, they became converted, and they all became stream enterers instead. So that story goes on for quite some time. Then, that time, the Lord was doing walking meditation in the shade of the Vulture's Peak mountain. Devadatta, having climbed the Mount Vulture Peak, hurled down a great stone, thinking, "With this I will kill Recluse Gotama." But the two mountain peaks having met crushed that stone, and only a fragment of it having fallen down drew blood on the Lord's foot. The Lord, having looked upward, spoke thus to Devadatta, "You have produced great merit, foolish man, in that you, with your mind malignant, your mind bent on murder, drew the Tathagata's blood." And then the Lord addressed the monk, saying, "This monk is the first deed whose fruit comes with no delay, this Anantarika Kamma, accumulated by the Devadatta, since he, with a mind of malice, drew the Tathagata's blood." And so this is a kind of karma which leads to rebirth in hell, without any
one-way ticket.
Yeah, like a one-way ticket, without any so murdering a mother, murdering a father, murdering an arahant, injuring the Buddha, and causing a schism in the Sangha, the five Anantarika Kammas. Right now, at that time, there was a fierce elephant in Rajagaha called Nalagiri. Devadatta spoke to those in charge of the elephant stable, saying, "We, my good friends, are relations of the king. We are competent to put in a high position, one occupying a lowly position, and to bring about an increase in food and wages. Well now, good fellows, when the recluse Gotama is coming down this carriage road, having let loose the elephant Nalagiri, bring him down this carriage road." "Very well, sir." Then they did so, and when they let loose the elephant, and when the elephant saw the Lord coming from afar, he lifted up his trunk and rushed towards the Lord, his ears and tail erect. When the monk saw that, the monk said, "Lord, this elephant Nalagiri is coming. It's a fierce man-slaying elephant. Lord, let the Lord turn back. Let the welfare turn back." "Wait, monks, do not be afraid. This is impossible, because it cannot come to pass that anyone should deprive the Tathagata of life by aggression." So at that time, people mounted up on the longhouses and the curved houses and the roofs, and they waited there to watch the show. Then those people who were of little faith, not believing, of lowly intelligence, they spoke thus, "This great recluse is indeed lovely, but he will be hurt by the bull elephant." But those people who had faith and were believing, who were wise and intelligent, they spoke thus, "Soon, good sirs, the bull elephant will come into conflict with the elephant among men." And this is a pun on the word naga, yeah? So now the naga will meet the naga. We talked about this in the suttas the other week. Then the Lord suffused the elephant Nalagiri with loving kindness. And the elephant Nalagiri, being suffused by the metta, having put down his trunk, approached the Lord. Having approached, he stood in front of the Lord. And then the Lord, stroking the elephant Nalagiri's forehead with his right hand, addressed the elephant Nalagiri in verses. "O Naga, do not strike the Naga among men, for painful elephant is the striking of the Naga. There is no good destiny, Naga, for a slayer of the Naga when he is hence beyond. Be not proud, be not wanton, for the wanton reach not a good destination. Only that you should do by which you will go to a good destiny." Then the elephant Nalagiri, having taken the dust off the Lord's feet with his trunk, and having scattered it over his head, moved back bowing while he gazed at the Lord. And then he went back to his elephant stable and stood in his own place. So we read, I think last year we read the version of this from the Ekotara Agama, and it had much more exotic details as this, and these are kind of always become much bigger as time goes on, but the heart of that is a very, very beautiful story. So, then a few more stories, but then Devadatta approached. Then Devadatta started to cause a schism by getting a group together, and he approached various other monks, and he said, "Come, we, your reverences, will make a schism in the recluse Gotama's order, a breaking of the concord." When he's spoken thus, Kokalika said to him, "But how are we to do this when the recluse Gotama are of such great psychic potency?" And then Devadatta said, "We, Your Reverence, having approached the recluse Gotama, will ask for 5 items, saying, 'Lord, the Lord many ways speaks in praise of desiring little, of being contented, of being of decreasing the obstruction of putting forth energy, and these 5 items in many ways contribute to that. It would be good if the monks, for as long as life lasted, might be forest dwellers.'" This is number 1. "Because evil will overcome one who lives in the neighborhood of a village. Let them be beggars for alms, and let them not accept invitations to eat. Let them be rag robe wearers, whoever should not accept a robe given by householders. They should live at the root of a tree, and let them not eat fish and flesh, much amongst her." Okay? "It is possible, Your Reverence, with these 5 items, to make a schism in the recluse Gotama's order. For your people, for Your Reverence, people esteem austerity." Yeah? So this is his motivation. He's trying to cause a schism. And a very skillful way of doing so, because especially in India, more than anywhere, people do indeed esteem austerity. And if they have a group of monks who are going around keeping rules like that, everyone would think, wow, they're really good. So he went and made this proposal to the Buddha. The Buddha's response was, "Enough, Devadatta. Whoever wishes, let him be a forest dweller. Whoever wishes, let him stay in the neighborhood of a village. Whoever wishes, let him be a beggar for alms. Whoever wishes, let him accept an invitation. Whoever wishes, let him be a rag robe wearer. Whoever wishes, let him accept a household's robes. For 8 months, Devadatta, lodging at the root of a tree is permitted by me." That means for the time outside of the rains retreat. "Fish and flesh are pure in respect of 3 points, if they are not seen, heard, or suspected to be killed on purpose for him." Okay. So Devadatta, thinking the Lord does not permit these 5 items, joyful and elated, rising from his seat with his friends, having greeted the Lord and departed. So then he tried to cause a schism on that basis. And so on and so forth. And he announced he would do the opposita separately from the monks, went off and took his own group of 500 Vajiputtaka monks, a significant little detail, young monks from Vesali, who went to Gaya Sisa and sat down. Now then Sariputra Moggallana went along to see if they could help out. The monk saw them going off to Devadatta, and then this monk who saw them going off started crying not far from where the Buddha was. And the Buddha spoke thus to that monk, "My monk, are you weeping?" And he said, "Even those, Lord, who are the Lord's chief disciples, Sariputta and Moggallana, even these are going over to Devadatta, approving of his Dhamma." "It is not possible, monk. It cannot come to pass that Sariputta and Moggallana should approve of Devadatta's Dhamma. They've merely gone to convince the monks." So when they arrived to see Devadatta, Devadatta said, "You see, monks, how well taught the Dhamma is me, that even those who are the recluse Gotama's chief disciples, Sariputra and Moggallana, even these are coming to me, approving of my Dhamma." When this was said, Kokalika said this to Devadatta, "Devadatta, do not put your trust in Sariputra and Moggallana. Sariputra and Moggallana have evil wishes and are under the influence of evil wishes. Enough, Your Reverence. Let us give a welcome to these since they approve of my Dhamma." Then Devadatta invited the Sariputta to half his seat, saying, "Come, Reverend Sariputta, sit here." "No, Your Reverence," said the Venerable Sariputta, having taken another seat, sat down to one side. Devadatta, having gladdened, rejoiced, roused, and delighted the monks far into the night with a talk on Dhamma, asked Venerable Sariputta, saying, "Sariputta, the order of monks is without sloth or drowsiness. May a talk on Dhamma occur to you, Reverend Sariputta, for the monks? My back aches, and I will stretch it." "Very well, Your Reverence," the Venerable Sariputta asks Devadatta in assent. Then Devadatta, having laid down his outer cloak, folded in 4, lay down to sleep on his right side, and as he was tired, forgetful, and inattentive, he fell asleep at that very moment. So then Venerable Sariputta and Venerable Moggallana exhorted the monks and taught them, and all of the monks became stream entrants in those very seats, and they led them off before Devadatta woke up. And then Kokalika said to Devadatta, "Didn't I warn you that they have evil wishes?" Then at that very place, hot blood came out of Devadatta's mouth. Okay. Now, when this story was told about what had happened in that night, then the Buddha asked Sariputta, what happened that evening? And the Sariputta said, Bhante, he said, just as when the Blessed One, having glad and rejoiced, roused and delighted monks with a Dhamma talk far into the night, so in the same way did he ask me to give a teach. My back aches and I will stretch out. Just this was the line of conduct which Devadatta followed. And the Buddha said, formerly, monks, once upon a time, there was a great pond in a stretch of forest. Bull elephants lived near it, and these, having plunged into that pond, having tugged up the lotus fibers and stalks with their trunks, having washed them well and chewed them free of mud, swallowed them. Thus there came to be for them both beauty and strength, and not for this reason did they incur death or deadly suffering. But, monks, among these great bull elephants were young elephant calves, and these, imitating them, having plunged into that pond, having tugged up the lotus fibers and stalks with their trunks, but not having washed them well, having chewed them with the mud, swallowed them. Thus there came to be for them neither beauty nor strength, and for this reason they incurred death or deadly suffering. Okay, so this is the story of Devadatta in brief. So this will give you some idea of the background to the current sutta.
What was that book again that you're reading from?
This is from the Vinaya. This is we call the Khandakas. And Khandakas is published in the Pali version in two books. This is the second half of it, which is called the Chulavagga. So the Khandakas has 20 chapters. One of the chapters deals with schism in the Sangha. And it has really 22 chapters. One of the chapters deals with schism in the Sangha. So that's mainly about Devadatta and then the consequences of that. Yeah.
And that's available to read. That's in English or not in Pali?
That's in English, yeah.
What about
you? Usually kept in my room.
Sure.
Yeah, somebody comes out there, but if you want to have a look at it, then just ask me. Right. So this was all a commentary on the words Devadattang Arabha. Okay. Very, very. That's why the Pali is so nice, because it's got these stories, but they're put in still a very simple, very touching way, you know, just that little thing about taking the dust off the Buddha's foot and sprinkling over his head. In the later version, there's all kind of all this psychic stuff, and there's all this kind of, it just gets so over the top, you know. And that's just those little details is what makes the story really nice.
The one thing I found a little hard to accept was you had a certain amount of monks that kind of went off with Devadatta. And then while he was conveniently sleeping, that's all right, Sariputta and the Moggallana, and they taught the Dharma, and they became stream emperors.
Yeah.
I think what strikes me about that one is that, one, these monks, you know, obviously had minds that were able to be corrupted to a sense to go off with Devadatta, so they didn't have really a strong Dharma practice, one would assume. And secondly is that, the fact that Sariputra and Moggallana could just teach these particular monks, and then they became stream entries, I just find a little hard to accept.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that that particular aspect of this story is definitely exaggerated, and also the story of the assassins becoming stream enterers and things like that.
Sure.
That's characteristic of the Khandakas have... Very important. Khandakas are essentially teaching Vinaya, but they have a lot of this kind of narrative and background material. And that kind of conversion is very characteristic of that strata of material within the Khandakas. Like when we're reading the Madhyama Nikaya, we very rarely find that kind of thing here. But in this literature, that became very common. So my personal theory is that this passage was composed and put together after the Second Council. And one of the reasons being that I mentioned that it was significant that the monks of Vajjiputtikas, the Second Council was a dispute between the Vinaya monks, or the Pavayakas, and the laxist or badly behaved monks who were from Vajji, the Vajjiputtika monks. So what I think that this story has done is it's backdated the fact that the Vajjiputtikas were the enemies, they were the bad guys in the Second Council, and it's now backdated them to say, well, of course, they must have also been the bad guys in the time of Devadatta. Yeah? And so this is the kind of legendary elaboration which I think is going on here. Yeah. But having said that, and I certainly agree that historically I wouldn't take that seriously, but having said that, you could imagine psychologically that for those monks, obviously they're kind of young monks, they're a bit clueless and so on, a bit deluded, but there's that thing where they were probably very confused and very remorseful, but within that space, sometimes that's what actually makes you go much deeper and investigate what are my motivations, what am I doing. So they might have like gone forth originally for fairly shallow reasons. We've seen in the sutta that even some of the great disciples went forth originally for fairly shallow reasons. And now maybe they're having to wake up to this, oh, hang on, what's going on? Yeah? And then for the first time feeling that kind of sense of remorse, which is making them take the Dhamma more seriously.
That they had actually been misguided.
Yeah.
That they had allowed themselves to be misguided.
Yeah.
And that was a, sort of something that sort of sharpened their mind.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, cause I think there's, you know, something interesting there, but it certainly wouldn't take it too literally.
Sure. And also, David, that I was mentioning in the sutras, you know, obviously, he developed a lot of spiritual power. You know, so, I mean, in himself, I mean, I think what this sutta shows is that, you know, how vulnerable we are to the very, very end.
Right.
We can even, you know, become a master of concentration but still slip.
Yeah.
Still fall into feeling we're superior to others.
Yeah.
So, you know,
absolutely.
At the very end, we can become corrupt.
Yeah.
And to take great care. So I think David Dutt obviously would have had a lot of strength, his own strength. Bring people, charisma, if you want to use that word, to get a following. And obviously he had quite a lot of fun to present to the Buddha, you know, look, but really.
Yeah, he wasn't suffering from low self-esteem.
You know, so I mean, obviously he wasn't shy in coming forward.
Yeah, yeah.
His plans. But having said that, at what age do you think the Buddha would have been when Devadatta, you know, approached him and said,
yeah,
it's time for you to retire.
Well, obviously towards the end of the Buddha's career, Ajatasattu probably didn't become king again until towards the end of the Buddha's career. So I would be looking towards, say, the last decade of the Buddha's life. Say Buddha would have been in his 70s, probably. Yeah, and if the Sakyan princes were, say, 20 or 30 years younger, they would have been maybe in their 40s or 50s. I don't think Ananda would have been more than 60 at the Parinibbana, probably younger than that, probably 40 or 50 actually at the Parinibbana. Yeah.
I felt a real sense of dread when you were speaking about the rock. Devadatta throwing the rock and drawing the blood of the Buddha.
Yeah.
Mind you, the two peaks of mountains came together to be able to deflect the rock.
So that was, yeah, that.
Me too.
The drawing of the blood.
Now, after that, see, this is where these things are mixed up, but after that episode, the Buddha went to hospital, so he stayed in Jivika Zambavana. And so the whole Samanyapala Sutta belongs in that point in the thing while the Buddha is recovering.
Really? Hospital?
Well, it was a bamboo grove of the doctor Jivika, and he gave it to the Buddha, gave it to the Sangha because it was near to Rajagaha. So that when the Buddha was sick, he wanted to treat him. He could treat him easily. He didn't have to walk up the whole vulture's peak to treat him.
In Gains and Honours, there's a whole samyutta devoted to Gains and Honours and how terrible they are. So I included them in my anthology.
Dharana. Okay. Bhikkhus. Here a certain clansman, Kulaputta, Kuladhita, and goes forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, thinking, I am a victim of birth, aging and death, of sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair. I am a victim of suffering, a prey to suffering. Surely an ending of this whole mass of suffering can be known. So it's a very beautiful phrase here. Otiernomhi, otierno. Overwhelmed, overcome, swamped. The tsunami has overcome me. tidal wave. Oh, der Nom he, I am overwhelmed. Jatiya, with birth, jara maranena, with aging and death. So kehi parideve dukehi domine sehi upaya sehi. Dukho tirno, overwhelmed with suffering. Dukha pareto, a prey to suffering. Apevanama imasa kevalasa. Could it not be, or perhaps it would be that dukkha kevalasa, this entire universe, mass of suffering, anta kirya, anta is the end, making an end, panya yeta, would be made known. Surely there would be made known an ending of this entire mass of suffering.
This is in a timely second.
Yeah. Oh dear, no, everybody. Then this is the same word that's also in the Sangadisesa 2-4. Otieno viparanetena chitena. And so here it doesn't just mean affected by or something, it means overwhelmed by. So, evang pabhajito. So, having gone forth, pabhajito samano. We've found this idiom many times. This is the to be, the verb to be. In this particular form, it means when pabhajito samano means this being the case. It being the case that he's gone forth. Labha, gains. Okay, labha, gains, honors, sakara. Siloka, fame, abhinibhateti, they appeared or manifested for him. So, and then with that, lava sakara silokena, with that, is the instrumental ending, he was happy, pleased in mind, and his intention, his sankapa, was fulfilled, pariporna. And then, with that, gains, honors, and fame, he attanukangseti, he ukkangsa himself, he praised himself, and parang vamheti, he vamhud the others. I'm ukkang, and they're vamha. I'm good, and they're not. Ahamasmi labhi silokava, I am famous, and have lots of stuff. These others, because apanyata means they're not, what does it say, not to be reckoned with. They're not unknown, of no account, apesakha. And so, with that gain, honors, and fames, he is majjati, he is drunken with them. He is pamajjati, he is even more drunken with them. He's off his face. Pamadanga pajati, he falls into negligence. Pamato samano, being negligent. Samano here, same word we found here. Dukkhang viharati, he dwells in suffering. Just as, because, suppose a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, came to a great tree standing possessed of heartwood, passing over its heartwood, okay? Atik kameva sarang. Atik means, ati is over. Kama is going over. Passing over the sara. The sapwood, the inner bark and the outer bark, he would cut away the twigs and leaves and take them away, thinking that they were heartwood. And then a man with good sight, seeing him, might say, So thinking they were heartwood, here we have this term, manyamano. Saranti, manyamano. Now you met this term, manyana, in the other places, for notably in the Mulapariyaya Sutta, the Futmajima number 1, all those weeks ago. And this is like the thinking, the deluded, conceited thinking. Okay? Then some man would saw him thinking, well, he left the heartwood and took all those other things, the twigs and leaves. Whatever that man wanted to make with heartwood, his purpose will not be served. Okay? So if whatever you want to make out of heartwood, you want to make a door, you want to make some furniture, you want to make a building, you can't do that with twigs and leaves. Okay? Okay, so this is somebody who This is Bhikkhu is called one who has taken the twigs and leaves of the holy life and stopped short with that. Bhikkhu has taken the twigs and leaves of the holy life. Ah, some clansman's gone forth again, thinking, I am overcome with birth, aging, and death. He gains labha sakara siloka, but he is not pleased with that and his intentions are not fulfilled. He doesn't praise himself and criticize others, and does not fall into negligence. And so being diligent, being diligent, samano, apamato samano, sila sampadang aradheti, he accomplishes or achieves the attainment of virtue. So, with that attainment of virtue, he is pleased and his intentions are fulfilled. And then he praises himself and criticizes others. I am virtuous of beautiful conduct. Kalyana dhammo. Okay? Translated here is of beautiful conduct. And these other bhikkhus, ime pananye, pana, here having a meaning of but. Pana, ime pananye, but these other bhikkhus, dusila. Dusila. No good sila. Bad boys. Naughty papa dhamma of evil conduct. Okay? And so then he falls into negligence, and being negligent dwells in suffering. And so this is like someone who goes to seeking the heartwood, and passing over the heartwood, he cuts off the outer bark and takes it away thinking it were heartwood. Okay. Now, next one, and that's all repeated. So this is the bhikkhu who has taken the outer bark of the holy life and stopped short with that. So now the next one, the bhikkhu gains honors and fame. Then he gets sila sampadang, endowed with sila, but then he does not praise himself and criticize others for that sila, and then he does not fall into negligence, and then being diligent, apamato samano, being diligent, samadhi sampadang aradheti, he achieves the attainment of samadhi, and then he's pleased and his purpose is fulfilled. Then with that attainment of samadhi, he praises himself and criticizes others. Ahamasmi samahito ekaga citta ine pananye bhikkhu asamahita vibhanta citta. I am, okay, and may well be not a coincidence that ahamasmi is the great phrase that's found in the Upanishads and the Brahmanical scriptures. I am, yeah, the first words of Manu, when the first man, when he appeared in the world, ahamasmi. Yeah. Samahito, concentrated, yeah? One with samadhi. This is the past participle form of the word samadhi. Ekagga citto, one-pointed mind. Ime pananye bhikkhu asamahita. These bhikkhus are samahita, no samadhi. Vibhanta citta. Their cittas are all over the place. And the word vibhanta is the same word that's used to mean to disrobe. Okay, so vibhamati is the word to disrobe. And in the definition of disrobe for a bhikkhuni, it says a bhikkhuni doesn't verbally disavow the training by saying I disrobe. It says that she vibhamati, she goes away or goes astray. You would probably translate it from this one. They've got straying minds, you translate it. So maybe they go astray or leave. So, becomes negligent. And being negligent, pamato samano dukhang viharati, he dwells in suffering. Right, so then, again, seeking the heartwork, this time he cut off its inner, and it passed over the heartwork and its sapwood, he cut off the inner bark and took it away thinking that it's heartwork. This is somebody who is a monk who's satisfied with the inner bark of the holy life. Tachang, the skin. Now, next monk, not satisfied with gains, honors, and fame, not satisfied with sila, not satisfied with samadhi, he's diligent. So, jnana dasanang aradheti, he gains knowledge and vision. So, here knowledge and vision is explained, but knowledge and vision is used in many different ways in the suttas, and sometimes, for example, the attainment of jhana is considered to be knowledge and vision. Sometimes, very often, different kinds of psychic powers are considered to be knowledge and vision. And in this case, it's probably psychic powers, which is meant especially in the context of Devadatta. So, tena jnana dasanena atmano hoti pariporna sankappo. Okay, so then he gains that. He is pleased and his intentions are fulfilled. Then he praises himself and criticizes others, thinking, Ahamasmi jhanang pasang viharami. I abide knowing and seeing. Now notice that the difference here, when it says jnana dasanang, when the phrase refers to stream entry into actually seeing the Dhamma, then it's always yathabhuta jnana dasana, yeah, seeing things in accordance with the truth, okay, or in accordance to something, reality, or how they've been produced, or whatever, however you want to translate that. But here there's no yathabhuta, it's just ahamasmi jhanang pasang viharami. These monks don't dwell knowing and seeing. Ajhanang apasang viharantiti. So, this is the knowing and seeing. Now, and just to come back to the Ekotara Agama version, it gives much more context. Now, the Ekotara Agama describes how Devadatta had lost his supernormal powers but gained much favor with Ajatasattu. The latter was supplying him with 500 measures of food per day. And the Buddha, being told about this by the monks, warned them that these material gains will prevent Devadatta from gaining the goal for the sake of which he had gone forth. So, of course, this being the same story that we find in the Pali Vinaya that we just read. Okay, so actually, this sutta, according to this presentation, actually belongs somewhere in that narrative which we read out earlier. And so, this is what I was mentioning before about the way that these particular scriptures, the narrative sources in the scriptures, are scattered all over the place, okay? Which is very different how we do it. We of course want to put them all together in one and assemble one kind of definitive narrative, which is going to tell the whole story from beginning to end. But remember that these are oral scriptures, okay? So they didn't exist in books, they existed in people's minds, okay? So the fact that one of them might be in a vinaya and one of them might be in a sutta and one of them might be here, it doesn't really matter because they're actually all in your mind anyway. And you know them, so you can always call them up when you want, okay? So this is like a system of organization whose purpose is not so much for the actual presentation of the doctrine, but to ensure the memorization and to organize that, yeah? This is the way things are organized as they are in the suttas. But, of course, when somebody was giving the oral teaching, they would expand it or condense it as they saw fit on that occasion. If they had a lot of time and they wanted to go, they could expand it. If they taught to teach it in brief, they can just teach it in brief. And also all these different, this is why it seems a bit disorganized to us. Now, the Ekotara Agama version, in terms of the Dhamma, it's taught as much the same as the Pali. There's not really any substantial differences. One difference that it does have is where the Pali has the knowledge and vision, the Ekotara Agama talks about the gaining of wisdom. Okay? And contrasted this with the supernormal powers, the worldly supernormal powers. And then it has some verses and things like that. And so it has a bit more kind of elaboration on it and puts it a bit more context. The Pali often is very stripped back. So, and that stripped backness of the Pali can be understood in two ways. Either it's from an earlier tradition, which is less elaborated, or it was like a characteristic of the way that the oral tradition was developed in the Pali tradition, that they tended to make the actual text simpler, and then elaborate it more, and the elaborations were kept separate, so they were given by the teacher, whereas in the other traditions, the elaborations by the teacher were kind of inserted in the text. Yeah. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the Pali tradition as a whole is earlier or later than the other, but it's just a different way that they actually treated the text and the way that they used it for their teaching and so on, and the different ways of looking at it. Now, the interesting thing here, which Venerable Analia doesn't mention here, which is a bit of an oversight, but next. Okay, so he goes, what does he do? He's seeking heartwood, And passing over the heart wood, he gets the saput. Okay? So this is the knowledge and vision. So then the next one. And here's...
He gets perpetual liberation.
Right. So here he's not satisfied with sila, not satisfied with samadhi, not satisfied with knowledge and vision. And then being diligent, he gets the asamaya vimokha. A means not, samaya is on an occasion, okay, so temporary. So when it says ekang samayang, on one occasion the Blessed One was living at such and such, okay, the liberation, vimokha. So some kinds of liberation may be temporary. For example, you get into samadhi, you can get your mind freed, but then later on the defilements will come back. So this is asamaya, so not temporary liberation. Atthana metang, it is not thana, it is not a thing, it is not place, literally, but here it means it's not possible. Another kaso, it cannot happen, there is no chance, there's no way. Yang so bhikkhu, that bhikkhu, taya asamaya vimuttiya, with that non-temporary liberation, parihayeta. Now this is very, very significant, and a shame Venerable Nanda has missed this out, but parihayeta is the exact word which is used in the Katavattu and other places in discussing the doctrine about whether an arahant can decline from their attainment. Okay? And so this is one of the doctrines which is debated among the schools. Can an arahant fall away from the attainment of arahantship? Okay? And it's from a Theravadan point of view, it seems a bit kind of bizarre. I mean, obvious that that's the whole thing about arahantship is you get it and you're there, you know. It's like, whoopee, you know, let's go to Byron and just chill out, you know. We're not gonna lose it. But it was quite controversial, and many of the schools debated this, and many of the schools had the opinion that certain kinds of arahants could fall away from their liberation. And the actual way that this was described is exact, using exactly this word. Can the arahant parihaya? Can the arahant decline or fall away? And I think usually if you look at these controversial theses which were discussed in later years, one of the rules of thumb with these things is that they were phrased in a way where they didn't directly contradict the suttas. When people were discussing them, they were always referring to the suttas in terms of seeking their authority for their particular statement and their particular view. So if you had a view which obviously and directly contradicted something which was found and accepted in the suttas, then it wouldn't stand. You would just quote the sutta and then it would be passed away. So what you find is that these things, they're kind of in these grey areas, and they're problems which arise in the areas where the suttas are not necessarily definitive one way or the other. This is where they tend to arise. So, for example, the question of do dhammas exist in the past, present, and future? Well, there's no kind of one place in the sutta where you can point to and say, well, here is where the Buddha asserts this in one sense or another sense. The same thing with the pugala. You know, does the pugala, the person, exist? Well, the way that they define the pugala is neither separate nor distinct from the khandhas. And, well, yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that that's not what the suttas were teaching, but it's difficult to find an outright passage that actually decides the matter one way or the other. Yeah? Now here, we do have such an outright passage. It says, the Buddha says, it's impossible, it cannot happen, that an arahant, one with asamaya vimutti, could fall away from that attainment. Okay? So this to me is quite a strong sign that this particular passage was likely not in the earlier version. And indeed, it seems, although it's perhaps not 100% clear from Analio's study here, it seems to me from his study that particular line is not found in the Akotara Agama version.
So this is a sectarian insert?
Seems to me likely, yeah. And that was one of the major disputed topics. You know, there's hundreds of minor disputed topics, but this was one of the major ones. Asamaya vimutti.
So you think this was inserted as part of this discussion?
Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't noticed this before this morning, but if my idea is right that the Devadatta story in the Vinaya, right, was assembled in the wake of the Second Council, then this is sort of part of that strata of literature, you know, part of that whole field, you know, of literature, and may well have been, you know, adjusted in the time of the schismatic discussions, okay? Which doesn't prove that it was put together after the schisms happened. It merely proves that they were taking sides in one way or another on an issue which at some time became characteristic of the different schools. Because of course the discussions on the issues happens a long time before the schisms happen. Yeah, typically. Yeah. It takes a long time for people to argue about it, to discuss about it, and talk about it. And there's a range of opinions. And then sometime, which may be generations later, that sort of they harden into fixed views and you consider this community consider themselves schismatic, yeah? But it's difficult to actually fix a particular point. The other interesting thing, of course, is that I mentioned at the beginning that there's no Sarvastivadin versions of this, and this is very unusual. We have the Digha, the Majjhima, and the Sangyutta of the Sarvastivadins, and the Vinaya, and the Mool Sarvastivadin Vinaya, and I don't know in terms of percentages, but there's only a small percentage of suttas of which we don't have the Sarvastivadin version, and they of course were one of the schools which held this idea that the arahant could fall away from their attainment. So
what's ultimate liberation for them?
Well, I think they had different kinds of arahants, and maybe some could fall away and some couldn't. I'm not 100% sure. I have to look up the details. But they probably also varied in the Sarvastivadin sub-schools as well.
That's interesting because, you know, of the very wise teachers I know, they all continue to practice just like the Buddha.
Mm.
You would think of the Buddha as enlightened and there's nothing more to do. He would meditate. But he actually spends a lot of time meditating. And what I heard from some teachers is that it's actually possible if you have a profound insight that you don't support it and sort of consolidate it in a way that the impurities can slip in again.
Mm.
They weren't talking about arahantship, they were talking about some of the levels before then.
Mm.
So that's just interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, and you can see that's very natural that would arise within a community. It's one of the principles that was formulated, principles of spiritual communities was formulated by Piyadhammo. See if I can remember, this would be called Piyadhammo's Law. Was that, he's one of our German anarchist monks, and Berlin punk anarchist monks. And he
came,
it's one of the whole group of them. They should get a monastery together, he and Analio and Jatamalo. And they, Piyadhammo's Law goes something along the lines of this, that a spiritual community will always attribute to their teacher the highest possible attainment which is not blatantly contradicted by the evidence or by the teacher's behavior. Yeah? Yeah. And so in that case, you know, it's very normal that people have very excessive ideas of their teacher's attainments and so on. And then they get then their teacher does things that are not don't appear to be conversant with that, and so then they find ways of excusing it, ways of finding ways around it and so on and so forth. And in some cases if the teacher is of kind of not honest or is of evil wishes, like say Mahadeva was supposed to have been in the first schism, then he will encourage that. But even if the teacher themselves doesn't encourage it, it can easily get currency within a community, even if maybe, you know, many years after they've passed away, it could even, you know.
So Melanie and I were talking the other day and came up with this question about what does it mean if you're an arahant and you're in a Thai monastery, which, while you're not personally sexist, the institution is. So there's some place where if you're not taking an active stand, you're actually perpetuating ignorance.
Yeah.
How do you explain that?
How do I explain it?
Well, if an arahant is, just from my very, very tiny experiences, you know, in emptiness, there's only a compassionate response.
Mm.
You know, because there's no self-mediating anything.
Yeah,
it's just compassion. Then how can you not be moved out of compassion to address structural inequities?
Because you're not looking at them.
Right, right, you're not looking at them. So that means there's a place that's blind. Because you're not seeing something.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite a challenging question, but it probably depends how you describe that. I mean, if you look at it from classical Buddhist terms, then one obtains your freedom from seeing the ending of one's own defilements. Okay, so you're not, in other words, you're not going to suffer. Right? Other people can suffer all they like. So this is obviously where you see that it's actually a similar problem or dynamic as with the Theravada Mahayana thing. Yeah, that the actual individual can obtain liberation, but if they're not seeing how that works in terms of a community. Yeah? But it's just a different kind of thing. And again, I can say the best analysis of this that made me really understand that was from Ken Wilber, and here's what he showed that it's just a different kind of thing. Looking at consciousness is a different kind of thing than looking at culture.
Yeah, we went
into
the
future. Right. Because it's not so much for me the type of thinking, but what tiny bit of what it means to be conditioned not to see things and for that conditioning to continue after arahantship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it means there has to be some kind of conditioning.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. But and the suttas are quite open with that. Yeah. You know, this is one of the reasons why it's always held, it's not explicitly stated so much in the suttas, but it's always held to be the case that one of the special powers of the Buddha is to lay down a vinaya. Because the vinaya is what governs the communal aspect of the Sangha. And this is why the Buddha quite frequently encountering the vinaya criticizes even the arahants, because they don't necessarily understand everything about how this is working out in terms of the community. Yeah? So for example, what was it? I think Anuruddha's students or someone were arguing amongst each other, and Ananda comes up and tells him, and the Buddha says, the Buddha says, Ananda, what are you talking about? You know, when has Anuruddha got himself involved in these kinds of things? You know, that's not the kind of thing he gets involved in, you know? This is the job for myself or for Sariputra Moggallana or somebody to look after. I can't remember exactly what he said in that context.
It's also a rule for the arahant that was chastised by the Buddha for storing rice grains and then re-eating them the next day, so he didn't have to bother with lay people.
Yeah, exactly,
people ask, why don't arahants want to get involved? Why should they?
Yeah.
Just, if you maintain the sense of peace about you, you're not out there as a social activist, you're not going to get involved in, you know, APEC and stuff like this, even if it is possibly good for other people.
Mm. Mm.
Your interest in such things would just diminish.
So in that case, it's not saying that the arahants have to be like that, but that it depends on people's character, yeah. And those character things are conditioned, and that's always accepted by the community. Is that those things are conditioned, and it depends on people's character.
Even Sariputta and Moggallana had different characters.
Yeah.
And one would teach up to arahantship, the other would just a stream wing and figure it out for yourself.
Sariputta is like short back and size, he'd wear a suit and a briefcase. Sariputta's kind of long hair and carries a guitar.
This is like a level of diversion.
What, sorry?
A level of diversion. It's just a question of,
Would
you think that the Buddha at times acted diplomatically, actually acted with diplomacy when he dealt, like, for instance, with a king?
For sure, yeah.
So there was a person there that was going to be killed by the king.
Yeah.
And he just seemed to deal so well with the...
Yeah, he acted very diplomatic with him. Yeah.
Yeah,
like when Ajatasattu, after he killed his king, we saw in that thing, he came and confessed it to the Buddha, and the Buddha said, well, it's good that you've confessed it, because making confession what you've done wrong is gain and progress in your spiritual life. Yeah. And then he left, and then he said to the monks, the king is doomed. Yeah. So yeah, he was. He obviously wasn't very diplomatic with Devadatta. But I think this is a very, very important question, a very crucial question, and it's something which I think, as Buddhists in our time, we have to address it. You know, no getting around it, no making excuses.
Is there not a case of a certain figure in another country, say Thailand, where there's claims that this person may or may not be an arahant, and they're acting in a certain way, which they're saying very strong things, getting involved, and they draw.
That's a Mahabua, you mean?
Oh, two words, and they seem to draw a lot of attention from various quarters, and some of that attention is not flattering.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of fault finding is built up around such commentary, and one has to wonder what benefit then that derives. Or derives from that actual activity.
Yeah.
Does it destroy the faith of those without faith, so to speak, or those with faith?
Are you talking about political activism? And
yeah. Well, his character seems to have political motivations in some way.
They told everyone to vote for Thaksin, so they all voted Thaksin, and then Thaksin got into power. It's probably one of the reasons why he got into power. And then he was the old one. And then he said, "Oh, Thaksin's really corrupt. Don't vote for him anymore." Everyone knew he was corrupt beforehand. He was already impeached before he got into power. Yes, it was very controversial. I mean, one of the things that Ajahn Mahabhu was doing is he's trying to seek a more proactive role in the community. You know, in a sense, the kinds of things we're talking about now. You know, as someone who is widely regarded as an arahant. He's saying, in a sense, the same thing that we're saying, that it's not just an arahant's role to purify their consciousness, but also to look at the wider social context. And now he's maybe not addressing the same kinds of issues that we might think is important, and he may be not doing it in the same kind of way that we might, but it's difficult for us to judge or assess that not knowing the context. And this, of course, is one of the problems, is that culture is much messier than consciousness. You can actually fully purify your consciousness, so we have faith, whereas you can never fully purify your culture, yeah? And so that's always going to be mixed up with stuff, and the way he does it, he's a kickboxer, and he always has been, he always will be, and so he gets out there and stimulates debate and raises questions and so on and so forth. So
of course monks mangy or dons.
Yeah, yeah. So
I know if you agree with this, which is, why some of us are here. But to have a structure of a cultural structure of monastic institutions talking about arahantship, to have arahants and for to be so sexist at the same time just feels so contradictory, that it actually doesn't do service to the Buddhist teaching. So because it speaks to a kind of compassion that is limited.
Yeah. That's true. But I agree with you completely. But also, could it not be the case that in 100 years' time, people will be saying the same things about us with regards to issues which we're not even aware of? Now,
if you made me aware of it, if you educated me, and I say I'm open to listening and respond to your suffering, not just personally, but culturally or institutionally, just even in terms of my monastery, then that's fine. It's that the ears are deaf in many of the monasteries.
Yeah.
You know, that's what...
But, yeah...
You know, I mean, putting the bhikkhunis in jail,
that's true, but it wasn't the arahants who was doing that.
But we haven't heard from the arahants.
Well, they probably didn't know about it. In that particular case, it happened in Burma and it wasn't in Thailand. So,
who was that? Said that the Buddha wasn't stupid enough to legislate for kings. I think it was Tanisiro who said that in one of his books.
Mm.
in the winning, he says the king was very diplomatic, but he wasn't stupid.
Mm.
He knew where to draw the line and not to get involved in things which were the affairs of state.
Yeah.
And things which monks and nuns shouldn't be discussing, usually anyway. As it talks of kings and wars and politics.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah, yeah.
There were wars happening at those times. So you're being massacred.
But I guess this issue is not a so much of not just a social issue, but it's an issue that directly affects us. So therefore we have to do something about it, because it reflects on us and something that we have to do.
Yeah.
I like what Bhikkhu Bodhi said, that high-minded people were not really in accepting of Buddhism because of its
But you know, you should ask the arahants these questions. Don't ask me. I don't know. I'll never ask them. So.
Okay. If you help arrange a trip for us to meet the arahants that you know, I would love to ask them.
Right. Look out. Yeah, maybe we'd be surprised.
Yeah,
would be great. I suppose the biggest thing that they're dealing with.
I'd have to translate. Feminism, Flewa Alai.
Is there a Thai word for
feminism? Institutionalized androcentric structures.
In the title, Soros feminism, see irrelevant, or something like that.
I can say, I know words for man and woman. Okay. So at the end of this discourse, according to the Pali version, the bhikkhu said, "That's good, Lord." And they rejoiced in the Blessed One's words. According to the Akotra Agama version, 60 monks disrobed at the end of the discourse, and another 60 monks became arahants. Much better ending, isn't it? Cool, huh?
But 60 monks didn't have
popular
discussion.
No, it doesn't, unfortunately. No, that was another one.
It's just like these round figures all the time that we get. You know, it's 500, it's 1,000, it's 60.
Hmm.
These must be just expressions of, oh, there's a few, or there was lots. Yeah, through all these suttas, and, you know, these round figures, 10,000 this, and there's 50,000 arahants flying through the air, and then there's, you know, 60 arahants here, and 60 streamers there, it's all these, you know, it's not 22, you know, 3.
No, you're right, it's not 22.
You know, I have to wonder how accurate these figures are, so, you know, who's doing the counting too? You know, like, Venerable went to the toilet, left the lake, and to come back, you know, like, somebody's dusted off to get, you know, some fruit or whatever, some pretzels, and go arms around early in the morning.
I think we can certainly accept the gist of your statement there, that numbers are generally meant to be accepted in terms of round figures in the suttas. Yeah.
Indicative.
Yeah. So this, just to clarify the last point, the we had the asamaya vimuti, and then here it says yachako ayam bhikkhave akuppa ceto vimuti, the unshakable liberation of heart. Etamattamidang bhikkhave brahmacharyang, this is the goal of the holy life. The sara, the essence of the sarana, of the holy life, the culmination, pariyosana, of the holy life. So this passage is clearly making an equation between the akuppa teto vimutti and the asamaya vimutti that we saw earlier, the non-temporary release. And so here we have the unshakable release. So again, if we were to understand this in terms of the doctrinal debates going on in the schools, what the Theravadins appear to be saying here is that, because this phrase here, akuppa vimutti, is found constantly throughout the suttas, okay? Akupame vimutti ayamanti majati, so in the standard declaration of arahantship, whereas the asamaya vimutti is quite rare. But by equating the two, that the Theravada school is now saying every time the Buddha or the Arahant said akupame vimutti, they're actually saying that they can't fall away from that attainment. Alright, that's it.
Okay, I wanted to come back to the meat eating.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we should take King Asoka as our idol.
Mm-hmm.
For that, or the work that he did for animals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Didn't he set up
vet? Yep.
He started vet.
That's right. And
ordered that no meat to be killed in his palace.
That's right. Yeah, and then banned certain kinds of killing animals in the kingdom. So, certainly was, these days when we go to India, we see that, like Sri Lanka, it's not completely vegetarian, but very largely vegetarian, certainly a much higher proportion of vegetarian stuff. And a lot of that probably is because of Ashoka.
And then is it that there's any meaning for this Chitta Vimutti and Asamaya Vimukha?
Yeah, that's right. Akupa Chitta Vimutti. Yeah, Akupa, that's right. Akupa is not. Kupa is shaking. Yeah, so unshakable. Yeah? Asamaya is not temporary.
Why not they use the same word?
I think it's because it's hard to say. It may be because that other section was put in by the editors at a later date. I don't know. Could be. It's quite an unusual phrase.
I think for the rest is they are using the same word.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, all the other ones, it says sila, and then samadhi, and then jnanadasana, and then at the end, it puts lava sakara saloka, sila sampada, samadhi sampada, jnanadasana, and then uses a different word here. Yeah, so you're quite right. That's maybe, could be a sign that the editors have changed the wording of it. Could be. Yeah. So that kind of change, what you'd want to do then is you'd go and compare it with some other versions, and we want to see is it have the same kind of change consistently in the other versions. Unfortunately, in this case, we don't have any other versions. It's just got the one other, which is it's got a different kind of ending, so it probably doesn't have exactly the same kind of phrase there at the end. But yeah, your point, that's quite a good point.
The other that you compare is the anime from another text?
Yeah. The other one is from the Ekotara Agama, which is a scripture of the... it's Mahasangika school. And that was in Chinese translation, part of the Taisho Tripitaka, but it's similar to the Pali Anguttara Nikaya, so parallel to the Anguttara Nikaya, but actually quite different. And last year we did some readings from the Ekotara Agama. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in Mandarin, yeah. Translated from some kind of Sanskrit. Yeah. Very badly. It's very, very bad translation. Very hard to read.
Mm.
Yeah.
Not this?
No, the Ekotara Agama. Yeah.
Okay, this sutta touches a lot on spiritual pride.
Mm.
And it's so easy if we have a sit and we judge it to be successful.
Mm.
And I use the word here, you can become intoxicated with that and hence get stuck in it and forget to look further than that particular experience.
Stoned on samadhi.
you know, so it touches very much on the concept of humility
within
the whole spiritual experience, and how we can get stuck in different places, and knowing that until the very end here, you know, until the mind's completely liberated, we can continually to get tripped over by hurdles that are presented in front of us. So how best to interpret it, our meditation experience in the sense of appreciation or gratitude of some sign of progress, but also not forgetting to look at what other possibilities there are as well. I mean, so I suppose the question is how best to hold not only our progress, you know, also the other end of the spectrum when, you know, the Pali word that you pointed out, you know, for the dispersion of mind, quite an interesting Pali word there, and you can certainly relate to when the mind's just dispersing and dissipating all over the place, but how best to hold things to not get stuck where we are.
I mean, one of the things is I think it's important not to make too much out of it, because in a sense it's natural. Yeah, it's actually quite natural to get conceited and attached to attainments, and it's going to happen anyway. But just not to get too caught up in it, and so you just to recognize when you start to think in that way or look down upon people and so on, and you know, just to recognize that and so on. The path itself will dissolve those things in its own good time, yeah? And so, you know, but, you know, you can also just to use those reflections, you know, if you find that you're going to one extreme or the other, like if you find that you're getting conceited because of your attainments, then you can sort of reflect on all your faults and mistakes and everything. And then if you find that you're getting too negative and depressed about it, then you reflect on all the good things that you've done. So you can use that as a kind of counterbalancing. And also just developing mudita, just developing the being able to have joy in what other people can do, even if it's only very little things. Then even if it's true, maybe everyone else is hopeless. Yeah? But at least they can do something right, you know. At least they can tie their shoelaces or something like that, you know. And you can have mudita for that. And so then when that's state of mind's in your mind, then those other things aren't there. Yeah. But I think that it is important not to be too, I mean, it's very common, you know, this kind of whole spiritual conceit kind of thing. And that's one of the things I think which is quite good in the Ajahn Chah tradition, is that because it is very much a community, then it's a bit harder to get away with that kind of thing. And there doesn't tend to be so much of that kind of spiritual conceit, a bit more down to earth, but there is quite a lot of it around. Yeah.
What I love about this course is it says, don't take your eyes off the real vision. That there's something much better than any of these others.
Yeah.
You know, which is total freedom.
Yeah.
Which of course we've been talking about, but that's what I love about this discourse, is that it's like just keeping a visionary.
Yeah.
The capacity of the Buddha to be able to stretch out a simile is just amazing. You know, for the similings, you know, expand it to include all these different twigs and bark and outer bark and bark. Like to be able to tease it out so much to explain all
the incredible stimuli.
It's
really good to sing this. Buddham Bhagavantam Abhivade Svakato Bhagavata Dhamma Namaste Svatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho.